WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our salute to National Poetry Month by replaying Terry's 2013 interview with Richard Blanco. His poem, One Today, written for the second inauguration of President Barack Obama, is included in the recent book, For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. Richard Blanco, who was 44 when he unveiled his poem in Washington, D.C., is the youngest of the five inaugural poets in American history. He also is the first Latino and the first openly gay person in that role. Many of his poems are about identity. His parents emigrated from Cuba in 1968. He grew up in Miami, aware of the mix of nostalgia and anger adults in his community felt towards Cuba. He now lives in Maine with his partner, Mark. Terry spoke with Richard Blanco in 2013, about a month after he read his poem One Today at Obama's re-election inauguration.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem from Looking for the Gulf Motel that's about your father. It's called The Port Pilot. And some of the lines in this poem refer to various jobs your father had. He was a meat butcher in a butcher shop. Did he work in a bank for a while? Is that the reference to counting money?
He was a bookkeeper.
A bookkeeper. Okay.
By trade.
Okay. So those are the two things I wanted to mention before you read the poem. Is there anything else you'd like to say before you read it?
Well, the genesis of this poem had to do with my finding out one day, many years after, that my father was a port pilot. And of course, Miami, there's these big cruise ship terminals. And one day my mom tells me that's what your dad studied or was going to do in Cuba. He was a port pilot. And so I just found that so interesting, that little factoid about my dad's life that I had never known before. And this is what happens when you grow up sort of in an exile family or immigrant family, you just get little pieces of information like throughout the years, and you got to piece all this stuff together. And so this is sort of piecing together some of my father. The port pilot. Before I knew him as a butcher coming home with bloodstains on his cuffs that mama could never wash out in the kitchen sink. Before I learned he'd spend all day in the sky in loafers and a necktie, counting other people's money in a tower with a view he couldn't afford. Years before he started gambling with me on cockfights at Dio Buridi's farm every Saturday night, teaching me how to bet on death. Long before he was diagnosed and staying alive became his full-time job, his agenda filled with appointments to kill whatever was killing him. A lifetime before I had to cradle him in and out of bed, he carried me on his shoulders over the jetty at the port. Minutes after I'm called to the hospital, I remember that day, sitting together on a rock, watching the ships glide past us, when he told me that years before he was my father, he was a port pilot in Havana, steering ships safely into harbor, then guiding them out to sea again, never to see them again, seconds before I hear his last breath, told to leave the room.
And this is Richard Blanco reading his poem, The Port Pilot, from his latest collection of poems, Looking for the Gulf Motel. What did it mean to you when your father told you he'd been a port pilot in Havana? Why did that have such a big effect on you? Because of the responsibility that he had, or because of the fact that he was guiding the ships to safety and they'd never know who he was?
I think that's an afterthought. As an adult at the time, I was much younger, and I just thought it was just neat as all hell. I mean, you got to understand the landscape of growing up in Miami, these huge, like, ships that we used to watch at, you know, going off into the Caribbean on sunset. And so I just thought it was so neat. But it was also sort of the story of my father, of how being such a sort of emotionally absent person, that, finding out these little bits and pieces about him and were so interesting to me. And since he died when I was relatively young, before I really was a really mature adult, I never got to sort of meet him in a way. And so through the poetry, I've gone back to these little tidbits and sort of tried to recreate him on the page and see what he meant to me and what our relationship was about.
Your grandmother was a very important figure in your life, and you write about her in a few poems. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of one of those poems, and it's called Queer Theory, According to My Grandmother. Do you want to introduce it for us?
Oh, sure. So my grandmother was as xenophobic as she was homophobic. I remember growing up so that anything that was seemed culturally odd or weird or strange was also sort of tagged as queer. And I'm talking like things like Legos and Fruit Loops. So anything that she perceived as strange, she also questioned in terms of my sexuality. And so I think that's where this poem sort of gets its a lot of its sort of energy from. But it was also, my grandmother was a very central figure in my life. It's one of those relatives that end up doing a lot of good for you in terms of all the harm that they did to you. And so this poem, which I thought at first was this very poignant, angry, bitter poem, first time I read it, people just were like laughing in their seats. And then I got the humor behind this, and I realized how I was treating the subject. And this is in the voice of my grandmother.
And this is your Cuban grandmother, who was your father's mother.
Yes, my father's mother.
Yeah. Okay.
Queer Theory, According to My Grandmother. Never drink soda with a straw. Milkshakes? Maybe. Stop buying your mother's Avon catalog and the men's underwear and those Sears flyers. I've seen you. Stay out of her Tupperware parties and perfume bottles. Don't let her kiss you. She kisses you much too much. Avoid hugging men, but if you must, pat them real hard on the back, even if it's your father. Must you keep that cat? Don't pet him so much. Why don't you like dogs? Never play house, even if you're the husband. So the poem goes on to catalog all these sort of atrocities my grandmother used to say. Towards the end, I'll pick it up about two-thirds into the poem towards the end. Don't watch Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie. Don't stare at the $6 million man. I've seen you. Never dance alone in your room. Donna Summer, Barry Manilow, The Captain, Antoniel, Bette Midler, and all musicals, forbidden. Posters of kittens, Star Wars, or the Eiffel Tower, forbidden. Those fancy books on architecture and art, I threw them in the trash. You can't wear cologne or puka shells, and I better not catch you in clogs. If I see you in a ponytail, I'll cut it off. What? No, you can't pierce your ear, left or right side. I don't care. You will not look like a goddamn queer. I've seen you, even if you are one.
That's Richard Blanco reading a poem from his latest collection, Looking for the Gulf Motel. Did you try to win your grandmother's approval by trying to fix yourself in her eyes and, you know, not listen to musicals or Bette Midler or look at your mother's Avon catalogs or any of the things she urged, you know, have a cat, any of the things
oh, yeah,
she urged
certainly.
You not to do because it was too effeminate?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, every you know, of course I wanted my grandmother's love and approval. So, at every turn I would try to please her and try to do things that and everything I did, there was always the before thought of, would my grandmother like this? And literally almost everything I did. So you never knew what you were going to get. You know, sometimes I'd do something or say something or ask for something that would be met with okay. And then sometimes there was these other responses that you couldn't stand. But nonetheless, yeah, I remember my grandmother. I always wanted to be in the Cub Scouts, and to her, that was queer.
Really?
So you would think the Cub Scouts, you know, boys camping.
Yeah,
that this
yeah.
Kind of, oh, no, because it was this also this cultural component. It's like, what is that? You know, that's queer.
Okay, so the first career that you had, the one where you thought you wouldn't be called queer, was being a civil engineer. But your grandmother threw out your architecture and art books when you were young, which are exactly the kind of thing you'd want as preparation to later be a civil engineer.
Yeah. No. Architecture was queer because it involved painting and drawing and things like that. So that was out the door. Civil engineers was manly. Part of that influence was also my father, and I think he also always wanted to be an engineer, and I don't think he had the opportunity to.
Was your mother any more supportive than your grandmother?
My mother was, I wouldn't say exactly supportive, but certainly not my grandmother at all. When I came out to my mom, one of the things I told her was like, Grandma was right.
Poet Richard Blanco speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with poet Richard Blanco, part of our salute to National Poetry Month. When Terry spoke with him, Blanco had recently served as the official poet for President Barack Obama's second inauguration, only the fifth inaugural poet in our nation's history.
So you live in Maine, where it's now legal to be married, and my understanding is that you and your partner Mark might, at some point in the future, get married. You have a poem about him I want you to read. And just to preface this, you grew up in Florida, but now you live in Maine because it's great. Where he has lived, and I guess where his work is too. So that must be quite an adjustment, living in the Maine climate, especially after big snowstorms like the one you recently had. But anyways, the poem I want you to read is called Killing Mark. It's not what it seems. You're welcome to introduce this or to just jump in and read it.
Okay.
And this is going to be an excerpt of the poem. We're just trying to squeeze in a lot of poems, so I've been asking you to excerpt them.
What's always sort of surprised me about this poem a little bit is that it is obviously Killing Mark. It is the title. It's about my partner. It's about me in a gay relationship. And yet, in the small town where I live in Bethel, this is one of the favorite poems, which is greeted with such enthusiasm, because I think what it speaks about is something that's really transcends a gay relationship. I mean, it's just something fundamental, and one understands a gay relationship is a relationship. So, Killing Mark. His plane went down over Los Angeles last week, again. Or was it Long Island? Boxer shorts, hair gel, his toothbrush washed up on the shore of New Haven, but his body never recovered, I feared. Monday, he cut off his leg chainsawing, bled to death slowly while I was shopping for a new lamp. Never heard my messages on his cell phone. Where are you? Call me. I told him to be careful. He never listens. Tonight, 15 minutes late, I'm sure he's hit a moose on Route 26, but maybe he survived. Someone from the hospital will call me, give me his room number, I'll bring his pajamas, some magazines. 5:25. Still no phone call. Voicemail full. I turn on the news, wait for the report. Flashes of moose blood, his car mangled, as I buzz around the bedroom, dusting the furniture, sorting the sock drawer. By 7:30, I'm taking mental notes for his eulogy, suddenly adoring all I've hated. 10 years worth of nose hairs in the sink, of lost car keys, of chewing too loud and hogging the bed sheets. When Joey yowls, ears to the sound of footsteps up the drive, and darts to the doorway, I follow with a scowl. Where the hell were you? Couldn't you call? Translation, I die each time I kill you.
I really like that poem. Who hasn't done that? Who hasn't had those horrible imaginings when the person they love is late?
I had a friend of mine who told me you can divide the world into two kinds of people: those that panic when you don't call in 5 minutes, and those that have no idea that they're the ones who are not calling.
So what does Mark think of that poem?
He likes it. It makes him chuckle as well. I think he totally gets it and understands. And it hasn't changed his behavior whatsoever. So he knows it's a love poem at the end of the day. And I think it helped him to understand sometimes why I do get so out of control and neurotic. It's not out of it's just out of I have that sense of that something's going to slip away any minute. Something I try to get better at in my day-to-day life and with other things, but that sense of impending doom and panic that sort of, I guess, follows maybe poets around. I'm not sure.
So are you a catastrophist about other things?
Yeah, and I think it's as an engineer, which is something that's sort of reinforced that as an engineer in your designs and whatnot, you're trained to figure out what's going to go wrong. That's how you design a lot of things. You're like, okay, that's a decently designed curve there on the road, but what could go wrong? What's wrong with this design? And you're constantly putting things up to the test and up to the test and over-designing and implementing things and safety factors. And if I wasn't like that already, you know, 25 years of engineering have pretty much reinforced that.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Terry. It's been wonderful.
Poet Richard Blanco speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. The story of the poem he wrote for President Barack Obama's second inaugural and the poem itself are included in Blanco's recent book, For All of Us, One Today, An Inaugural Poet's Journey. The next poem we're going to hear got a big response the first time we played it last month. But good poems get even better when you hear them a second time. This was written by our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, who's also published several volumes of poetry. The poem was initially published on the Poem a Day page of poets.org, which is run by the Academy of American Poets. Lloyd's poem is called, To My Oldest Friend, Whose Silence is Like a Death.
This is a poem I wish I hadn't needed to write. Unfortunately, it's all true. I know I'm not the only person in the world who's had a close friend go missing without any explanation. But I'm still heartbroken and totally mystified. To my oldest friend, whose silence is like a death. In today's paper, a story about our high school drama teacher evicted from his Carnegie Hall rooftop apartment made me ache to call you. The only person I know who'd still remember his talent, his good looks, his self-absorption. We'd laugh at what haven't we laughed, then not laugh, wondering what became of him. But I can't call because I don't know what became of you. After 60 years, with no explanation, you're suddenly not there, gone. Phone disconnected. I was afraid you might be dead. But you're not dead. You've left, your landlord says. He has your new unlisted number, but insists on respecting your privacy. I located your oldest son, who refuses to tell me anything except that you're alive and not ill. Your ex-wife ignores my letters. What's happened? Are you in trouble? Something you've done? Something I've done? We used to tell each other everything. Our automatic reference points to childhood pranks, secret codes, and sexual experiments. How many decades since we started singing each other happy birthday every birthday? Your last uninhibited rendition is still on my voicemail. How often have we exchanged our mutual gratitude, the easy, unthinking kindnesses of long friendship? This mysterious silence isn't kind. It keeps me up at night, bewildered at some stage of grief. Would your actual death be easier to bear? I crave your laugh, your quirky takes, your latest comedy of errors. "When one's friends hate each other," Pound wrote near the end of his life, "how can there be peace in the world? We loved each other. Why am I dead to you? Our birthdays are looming. The older I get, the less and less I understand this world and the people in it."
That's Lloyd Schwartz, our classical music critic, reading his poem, "To My Oldest Friend, Whose Silence Is Like a Death."